I have no financial relationships, unfortunately. That's very true. So yes, today I'm going to be talking a little bit about evaluating the impact of the Framework Convention on tobacco control negotiations and the actual negotiation process itself. And this is based on one specific paper that just came out in Health Policy regarding this research. So I'm hoping that many of you in the audience are familiar with the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, and if not, I hope that you will get more familiar with it in the future. It's the first global health treaty, the first treaty negotiated by the World Health Organization in its history, and it also represented the first global response to chronic disease. And it specifically addresses corporate accountability and really international trade impact on health, which I just came from the International Trade and Health session, and they talked briefly about tobacco, but really a lot of the issues that they were addressing in that session come back to the regulatory framework that was set out in the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, and now seeing whether or not it's going to be successful. And whether or not the FCTC is successful has huge implications on how we approach regulatory mechanisms for other global industries that have huge health impacts. So what differentiates the FCTC from other aspects of regulatory or WHO action in the past? So before 1999, WHO had passed 17 resolutions on tobacco. These were non-binding WHA resolutions, and so what really is specifically different about the Framework Convention is that it was a formal legal process that would be then binding on those states that ratify it. It was negotiated during six sessions between 1999 and 2003. It was unanimously adopted by the World Health Assembly in 2003 and entered into force in 2005. I always like to ask my students this question, so I'm going to ask the audience as well. In February of 2003, the negotiations were concluded with the United States refusing to accept the final treaty text, specifically saying that the ban on advertising was unconstitutional and they would have no ability to future ratify the treaty. But then in May of 2003, the night before the vote, the U.S. Secretary of State Tommy Thompson stood up and made a press announcement that the U.S. would not stand in the way of the ratification and adoption of the FCTC. So does anybody in the audience know what happened between February and May of 2003? So we invaded Iraq, and we had very low standing at the time in the international community. And at that moment, the United States was not going to stand in the way of the first public health treaty by standing on kind of these principles that were actually incorporated already into the treaty. So I'd like to just point that out because, again, we all know that nothing is evidence-based around here. And when it comes to policy and why states agree and don't agree often comes down to much broader conditions that we should be aware of. The treaty commits states to implementing a range of domestic tobacco control policies, and I highlight domestic because traditionally international law is used to control trans-border impacts between states, and that's really different in the case of tobacco control in the FCTC. If you think about tobacco control, what would be the most global trans-border issue that you might address? And that would be trade. And in fact, trade is never actually mentioned within the treaty text. On the other hand, there's very strong binding agreements regarding secondhand smoke protection, which you could argue is hardly a building-to-building issue, much less a country-to-country issue. So we're seeing the use of international law in a very innovative, different way in this case. And it's been ratified and adopted by a huge number of states in since the adoption in 2003, so that now 171 states are officially party to the treaty, meaning that either they have ratified and their parliaments or Congress have approved the treaty, and the contents of the treaty are binding international law on those states. What was really unique about the FCTC process was that nearly every country in the world participated. I'm sorry, I'm so short, and I just hate not being able to see everybody. So I'm worried about the mic, and I'm ready to just bust out. And
well, you're being recorded.
Okay, so I will stay put. But what you see here that's really different is that in environmental treaty processes, for example, very few states actively engage in the negotiations because the regulations that will be, you know, whether it's emission regulations or standards, they actually apply to a very small number of states. And what you see here with the active universal participation in the FCTC is the recognition of all countries in the world, whether they're high, low, middle income countries, that tobacco control is directly applies to them and they have a strong investment in the outcome of this treaty. So the treaty process was very intense. So there are six sessions. There was two a year for 6 years. These sessions lasted for about 2 weeks. I was at WHO at the time on the Framework Convention team, and there was just this spirit in the air that revolution was happening. And when WHO first started the process, there was a lot of internal discord over whether or not it was the right way to go and whether or not it was going to be successful in the end and whether countries were actually going to bind themselves to a treaty negotiated by WHO. And WHO staff at the time had this line, well, the power is in the process. And the fact is that it doesn't even matter in the end if the countries of the world ratify the treaty and implement it. The multi-sectoral process that we're taking the countries through in this intense negotiation is serving as a communication platform that is going to diffuse tobacco control policy around the world. And so the investment is worth it, and don't worry about the end product. So I've always thought about this line in follow-up and whether or not that was really true and whether this process had the power that WHO wanted to claim it had at the time. And then there was a lot of other rumors about whether or not it was having an impact. And there was a quote at the end of the process when it went into force by Philip Morris, CEO, that they had to recognize the power of the FCTC, specifically that the FCTC had accelerated domestic regulation of tobacco. And in 2005, this is before any aspect of the treaty is actually binding on any state. So this is his kind of reference to the actual negotiation process and not the kind of binding international laws impact itself. So again, these were the two kind of statements that made me think, is this true and can we go back and see if it happened or not? So my question was that did the FCTC negotiating process result in a global diffusion of tobacco control policies, and what national characteristics were significant in adoption? There had been some of this type of global diffusion work already done around environmental policies and seeing how the institutionalization of environmental laws at a global level had sparked environmental policy change at the domestic level. And so I kind of replicated those types of approaches for tobacco. And my hypothesis was that the negotiations provided this platform. I took the WHO hypothesis. I'm not sure it's my hypothesis, but the WHO hypothesis was that the negotiations provided a platform for increased communication and international learning through which tobacco control spread to many countries simultaneously. Beforehand, we had this one-to-one policy transfer where experts from one country, typically a high-income country, would visit a low-income country and help them devise their international laws, and specifically perhaps U.S. advocates going to Thailand, for example, and helping Thailand form their international law. And this was different because instead of reaching one-to-one, we were doing it simultaneously around the world to many countries at one time. And that this simultaneous learning process accelerated the adoption of these internationally promoted tobacco control policies by countries worldwide. So the methods that I took, I collected lots and lots of data. I collected country characteristics on all countries around the world, including their income, their region, their democracy level, trying to get at this idea of how much participation there was between civil society and the government, their tobacco production and what kind of role the tobacco industry might play in the country, and then smoking prevalence. I also collected data on the participation of that country in tobacco control, and I measured this by the number of delegates they sent to the negotiating body sessions, and whether or not they had members within GlobalLink, which is an international virtual network for tobacco control advocates. and whether or not they had participants in the FCA, which is the Framework Convention Alliance, and that was an NGO alliance that formed around supporting the ratification of the Framework Convention. And then finally, I collected and categorized all the tobacco control policies that were passed pre and during the negotiations, which was definitely the most difficult part of the data collection, since tobacco control is very dynamic, it's changing all the time, it's very hard to collect this this data, and it's also not always entirely significant, because as we know in the United States, tobacco control doesn't always happen at the national level, but the data that I was collecting is national. And I used the Tobacco Atlas from 2006 because that we don't have any data in tobacco control that shows kind of the progression of policy. We only see the last policy adopted. So I took 2006 so that I wouldn't get the post-ratification adoption, which wouldn't necessarily have been caused by the negotiations themselves, but would have been caused by their legal obligation to now follow the FCTC, which is important research to be done as well, but separate. In terms of the FCTC relevant policies that I studied, I picked three just because tobacco control is such a broad field. I looked at secondhand smoke restrictions, at advertising policies, and at health warning labels. And then I broke the policies into three categories. Weak, which was less than FCTC compliant. Satisfactory, which was FCTC compliant, or kind of WHO proposed policy. And then strong, which was the public health best practice policies. And just to kind of use an example of health warnings, that would be weak would be the kind of health warnings we have here in the United States on the side of a package. Tobacco is harmful to health. Moderate would be on the front or back up to 30% of the package without a graphic warning, which is required within the FCTC. And then strong would be 50% at the front and pack with a graphic warning, which is the current best standards advocated by public health organizations. So here's the data that I got just in terms of how many policies were adopted during that time period among all countries. And so you can see that in the midst of the negotiations, there is a rise. So the negotiations start in late 2000, and then by the height of the negotiations, 2002, 2003, there is a significant rise in the number of policies that were adopted during that period of time. More perhaps remarkable is the shift in the type of policies that were adopted during that period of time. If you see in 1996, the most often adopted policy were weakest kind of common denominator policies, where by 2005, the most commonly adopted is strong public health promoted policies. And what you see during the negotiation period is the massive increase in the number of policies that are adopted that are in line with WHO recommendations. So it does seem to reflect this growing recognition of what should be contained within a tobacco control policy within states. Just to put it into numbers, we see that in the pre-negotiation in all categories, there was an increase in the number of policies adopted that were FCTC or compliant or stronger during the negotiation and post-negotiation period, and that well over half, over 70% of those policies were compliant with WHO. In terms of what predicted the policies that were adopted, the kind of determinants that were significant that we found were that income level, the higher the income, the more likely that a country adopted a new policy, which is somewhat counterintuitive because you would think that high-income countries already had strong policies, and so they didn't necessarily had to revise them during this period, but in fact they did. We also found that Global Link membership was significant, and we had done an earlier study that just showed that the timing of FCTC ratification was also linked to Global Link membership. So the more members a country has within Global Link, the earlier they are to ratify the FCTC. So just interesting information about the power of these virtual networks and the civil society kind of interaction that takes place and then results in quicker policy change. Southeast Asia had the strongest strength of the policies adopted during the period of time, while Europe had the highest number of policies. And just if you type this data, and it's all scientific, and I'm an IR PhD, so I don't really do this. The really important thing here is that during this period of time, Europe also instituted new regulatory measures through the European Commission and around tobacco. And so I think what we see here is also Europe kind of driving this process and having an impact on the kind of the global diffusion that we're seeing. And the weakest diffusion was in Southeast Asia and Africa, or not Southeast Asia, excuse me, was in Africa and among the lowest income countries in the country, in the world. So just to make it really brief, but what we found was increased communication coincided with a rise in domestic policy change in the direction advocated by WHO. So there does seem to have been a shift during this process, that virtual networks are significant in diffusion, and that we really need to improve the outreach and this diffusion and communication to the low-income countries that still kind of remained outside of the process. And finally, the implications of this kind of data and this process are that similar regulatory processes could be applied to a number of transnational industries, including food and alcohol, automobiles, pharmaceuticals, and arms, and that international regulations can reduce regulatory divergence between developed and developing countries and support international norm convergence. And my last 2 seconds that I don't actually have, I'll just say that you know, what we see here is that countries actually adopted the policies in the negotiation period, and they then ratified a treaty that kind of solidified an international norm that was already there. And if we look at the data post-2005, there isn't a rise again in the policy adoption, and that's what we're working on now. But it continues, it doesn't spike again because it became binding. They spiked around this norm, and then they agreed to the treaty, and now they've kind of let off again. So these treaty processes themselves are around which norm convergence occurs and policy changes happen, not necessarily the binding part of international law.